Okay, so let's get started here. And so far, we have a pretty small group of people. I think it's probably a little more specialized topic for most people. Who do we have with us so far?
Marty Callahan.
Hey, Marty. Welcome.
Tim Harrison.
And Tim, welcome, Tim.
Lauren Jameson.
Lauren. Welcome to the team, Lauren. Everybody, welcome Lauren, one of our newest Peak Performers members up in British Columbia. So,
welcome, Lauren.
Welcome.
There you go.
Thank
Good
you.
Work. Okay. Who else do we have?
Seth Thoreau.
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
Seth Thoreau.
Oh, Chester. Yeah. Fantastic. Welcome, Chester. And we got a bunch of others lurking in the background, it looks like. So, but that's okay. Let's start with anybody who's on the call right now. Is anybody currently dealing with an issue that merits addressing? Landlord problems, rent too high, looking to do something with your current lease? I know we had a couple of those, but maybe they've been solved. One of them was Cedar. I haven't seen on the call yet so far.
Master Oliver, Marty Callahan.
Go ahead. Yeah,
I don't have a current situation, but I am in a environment where the landlord is not very friendly and is rather severe. Mm-hmm. I'm looking to get out of it. I'm in a shopping center, but I'm looking to get out and purchase my own building. I want to do that in a year or two. So I'm interested in anything you have to say about purchasing. I know this is about leases, but if there's time, I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, yeah, and it certainly merits. We have a good friend of ours that is one of the top SBA lenders on buying property in the country, Chris Hearn. And I think we have a couple of recordings and conferences we've done with Chris. That's probably in the member site. It's Chris Hearn, H-U-R-N. It certainly merits having a separate call like this about purchasing buildings in addition to the information that we already have up on the site. The short answer to that conversation is, it is complicated. The overall, what I would say is that the general wisdom is you're always better off to own your own building, right? But the reality is what we have seen in real estate recently just reconfirmed what I'm going to have to be on hold for half a second. Justin is trying to get on the call here with us too, so let me see if I can get him with us here. Yeah, he should be joining us here in just a second. But back on the conversation of the building there, Marty. The thing about it is, and Matt Smith, well, but on purchasing the building, you're absolutely better off if and when you can find a building that size-wise you're either 100% occupant or you're 51% or better occupant. The 51% or better is the SBA requirement to do the, their loan. And with that, the issue is, of course, what we've seen, and we've been through a few cycles like this. And Marty, you and I are old enough to remember, you know, the Smith, you know, several of the other cycles. But people have a tendency to get a short-term focus and think that, you know, real estate's always going to go up and it's always a good investment, and so forth. And, you know, last few years have proven even to younger folks that that's not always the case. The caveats on the building are, if you can move into something where your mortgage payment is going to be comparable to your rent payment, and if you can buy something at, you know, below market, if you find a, you know, if you can find a deal, then you're always almost always better off, I guess is the right way to say it. The flip side of it is it's not too much different than the rent versus buy decision in the house. So if you buy a building in a declining market and several later, years later you're going to want to move to a better market, you can certainly get stuck with something that's not very valuable to you, right? What some of our friends have done in the past was make the strategy of buy or build the small strip center, and put the school in and then use the school's rent to basically, you know, or actually use the rent of the other tenant to pay down the mortgage. The SBA requirement is 51%, which, you know, sometimes you can get around by, you occupy 51% and you downsize after the, you know, the loan has gotten established. But it certainly merits us having the conversation. What I will say is it certainly isn't the panacea. And over the years, it's always been on the back burner as one of the strategies for me. And in practical terms, with six locations, there was one of them that I owned for a number of years. That deal was worked out well at the time. But, you know, there are certainly advantages to being in a lease space where you're next to the movie theater, next to Toys R Us, next to the grocery store, whatever it might be. And a lot of times when you own your own building, you're ending up with something that doesn't have that kind of foot traffic. Unless you're talking about, you know, now getting into the real estate business and buying a multi-million-dollar shopping center. Matt Smith, on the short term, anything you would add to that observation on purchase versus lease?
No, and I think your analogy of like buying a home, you know, the rent, if you're going to pay rent on something and the price is going to be the same as you're going to pay for a mortgage, because of the tax benefits on that too, and the chance of increased equity is always a plus. So that's the real, I think the thing that is the most beneficial is you have a chance to, you know, it's not a guarantee, but you have a chance. You know it's a guarantee that if you're renting, that money's going to go, you might as well flush it down, because it's only going to somebody else to pay for their equity and their property, and they get tax write-offs and benefits that you won't be getting. So it's definitely a win situation if you have that opportunity. I think you should always take.
Yeah, and in general terms, the issue is if you find a building that's in a developing area where you think the school will be there for 10, 15, 20 years, or it's going to be something where you're going to own the school for 10 years and look to sell it to, you know, staff member or somebody else, and it's going to basically be there long term, then the equity play is pretty certain, right? Because real estate generally is going to match inflation at least, and so as you pay down the mortgage, then you have some value in the building. The thing to be, you know, the real caveat on commercial property, the same as residential, it's just commercial is more twisty when it comes to this, is if you're buying in an established area that might be on the decline, is you can certainly end up, you know, paying, pick a number, $1 million for a building that's worth $500,000 in 5 or 6 years. In general terms, it's a useful retirement strategy in part. So if you're going to, you know, 20 years from now, you really have two things that you might be able to sell. You have the school, which is, right, the difficult one, and then you have the building. And so if you have a building that you bought for, use that $1 million number, $1 million, it's now worth $2 million, and you've managed to pay off the mortgage, then you have something that's sellable separately from the school, sellable with the school, or you can sell the school, which is the most common strategy, is you can get somebody to take over the school who's then paying rent to you and become landlord as opposed to a business owner. So all of those are certainly possibilities.
Yeah.
But anyway,
the only thing I would tell us to be cautious about is the condition of the building. The last thing you want is to go into some place that you're going to have to spend a lot of money to renovate it. It's not a new building. The newer the it's like a home. The newer the home, the better the less maintenance that you're going to have to do in the near future.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I owned a building before, a commercial building before, so I'm familiar with a lot of that.
Yeah, we can certainly expand on this in the future, but the the one thing about being owning the property versus leasing is there really is an advantage to you're in a shopping center, somebody else is responsible for all the common area maintenance. You don't have to ever worry about plowing the snow, mowing the lawn, any of that kind of stuff. And, we certainly know what happens is we all have just a certain amount of, I think of it as bandwidth. You have a certain number of things you can worry about at any minute. And if you're having to worry about the roof is leaking and the lawn needs to be mowed and, all of that kind of stuff, it's taking away from more productive activities like you have in the community market in your school, right? So there is always that trade-off. And again, when you make the trade-off, it has to be truthfully that, like in the one case that I did it, I was consolidating a central office and a school. Went from about a 3,000 square foot school and about a 3,000 square foot office and bought a 6,500 square foot building. And that worked out really well. And by the time I was done, I had reduced my rent. Although I was always irritated by the fact that I needed to worry about, getting somebody out to mow the lawn and it snowed and there's nobody else taking care of that. So, you do have to be aware that it comes with some of those other irritations. And as we know, a triple net lease, you still have to worry about the air conditioning and stuff because the landlord, abdicates all that stuff to you. But owning the property does add some complications to all that stuff. But again, one of the things that you should be aware of is, you tend not to find the perfect deal exactly at the right time when your lease is expiring and now you have a month to look for something. That tends to be when you end up with making the decision on something that's over market or maybe not in the right location because you have a need to. And so, Marty, as you were talking about, one of the things that has always been like the fix and flip guy strategy is to be looking for things pre-market. And one of the strategies that really everybody should be doing is constantly out there thumping for and looking for properties that might be a perfect fit and good traffic areas and so forth, and looking at ones that aren't on the market yet. Because what happens is if you're kind of in front of the various owners, that could be 15, 20 properties, you're going to have one where the owner dies or where they get divorced or they're going to move to Florida, whatever the way it might be. And if you're the first person out there in front of them, you can certainly end up with that being the strategy to find the perfect property, but also to get it below market or at least before they before they list it and go through all that. But let's shift to the conversation about leases. Matthew Smith, let's spend a little bit of time here. I don't know if there's anybody on the call right now who is having a problem with your current landlord. Marty, you said that your guy's kind of mean. The sense that I have with landlords is the more they just leave me alone, the better I like them. And the more they're active and engaged and contacting me and so forth, I tend to be, more problematic. And a lot of them, see, the higher quality shopping center you move into, the more they're going to want things done, their way. But I tend to view landlord-tenant relationship is one is you pay the rent and leave you alone. Ash Smith, what would you add to that?
Well, you know, the landlord that I have
recorded.
Now,
if you do not wish to be recorded, please disconnect at this time.
The landlord that I have now, I never hear from. You know, as long as I send my check in on time, you know, all I get is a statement from him each month, and really no problems. And that's the real key. Once you have a place, you know, in the past, I've always tried to have places that we stay in and not keep jumping around because I think it builds your name in that area or that community. People get to know where you are. But if you have a landlord that is giving you problems or keeps escalating the rent beyond what all the other rents are in the area, that's the reason I left my last place, which was just across the street. He was raising rents when everybody else was lowering rents, and when I negotiated it, since I had been there for over 15 years, he thought that I wouldn't leave, and he was very inflexible. So I went and found another place across the street at half the price and got 8 months free rent, and they did the build out. So there are places like that, but you know, the more time you have to look, the better off you are. Just make sure you don't have somebody who's giving you ultimatums. Even when I went looking for places, I actually negotiated on four different places at the same time with the understanding that I would take any one of those four depending on who gave me the best deal. And I had some of them that were really pissed off because I took another deal that was better than their deal, and they thought they had the deal done because we had negotiated back and forth several times. But you owe no loyalty to any of those people because you're looking for the best deal and what's going to fit you the best, you know. Considering all circumstances, I had one that was a lower price, but I didn't think the center was as nice as the one that I was in. And even though it was a couple bucks or more a month square foot, I felt it was worth paying it. So, you know, it's not always price, it's value too. So make sure you find the one that's going to meet all that criteria.
Yeah, and keeping in mind within that, I mean, it's always a free market, but there sometimes isn't a lot of rhyme and reason to why one property may be, you know, pick a number, $25 a square foot, and the other property is $17 a square foot. I was looking, Matt Smith, you looked at these with me to relocate one of our franchises here, and there were two spaces. One of them was $10 a square foot more than the other, and the reality was the base rent was about the same. It was all, one was in a different town, and they had $8 a square foot more in taxes and different things that were, you know, legislatively, they didn't have any choice that passed along. And so a lot of times you just got to be, you know, it's just like, again, buying a house or buying a car or buying anything. If you're fixated and have to have one, then emotionally and strategically, you end up with a crappy deal, right? But if you have three or four options that you're working on, and in this case, and Matt Smith, you're involved in helping with this as well. But in this case, it was move from the shopping center that had started out nice and gone to hell to a little smaller strip center that was really nice. And ending up with literally 1 year out of 5 years free rent on the deal and $1,000 a month less in rent. Now, that hadn't been said, Master Smith, you said it to begin with, is one of the companies I looked at one time was H&R Block. And, you know, one of their issues they knew is that when they moved the location, their business fell for the next year or two because, you know, people would know where they were, and then suddenly when they moved, it was problematic. And as you said, Master Smith, you know, if you can be in the same place in 5-year increments or whatever for 20 years, generally you're better off because of the visibility neighborhood and so forth. The flip side to that is the irony is that I have rarely found the landlord of the location that we're in is willing to be as flexible and negotiate as well as the person looking to get a new tenant. And so the irony, and it's just the psychology they have, is that if you're in the shopping center and the lease is coming up, if you don't at least go and shop 3 or 4 other spaces, get the best deal you can, and then bring it back to your current landlord, in almost all cases you're going to get a pretty crappy renewal deal. And in many cases, I find the existing guy isn't willing to match the guy down the street. They think that your computation is going to be the difficulty of moving and so forth, and you may not be willing to do that. But the more aggressively you negotiate, the better. Has that been your experience, Mr. Smith? I know certainly in that example you just gave it was.
Yeah, I think you were right on that part.
Yeah. But when it comes to negotiating, let's say that we're talking about a move because everybody's got existing schools, or it's a second or third location, I think what we have to recognize is a couple of points of reality is that it has gotten better, but it's still not great. See, if I'm in the, whatever it is in your area, say it's Safeway, if I'm looking at a high-quality shopping center that's anchored by a grocery store or something, the local area, magnet shopping center. The owner of that property, and oftentimes they're kind of big, it's the Teachers Retirement Trust of Illinois or something that owns it, and it's a property management company controlling it, is on their list of priorities of what the rental agency or the rental guys are looking for. Martial arts school isn't on their list of priorities. And in fact, they have a few things that only they rent to when the shopping center is completely gone to hell and, it's on its last legs. And, at the bottom of the list is the guys who are running a bingo parlor and, the people who want to rent it for a church. But martial arts schools, aren't on the top of their list for sure. They'd rather have Starbucks and, a number of other well-known national tenants. So when they're negotiating with a new landlord, the first important thing to do is to position yourself to be comparable to those national credit tenants. And, Master Smith, I don't know if you taught this to me or how I figured it out, but back in 1983 when I opened all the schools, the first thing I did is I put together the 300-page business plan, and I gave them all the marketing materials we were going to use, and I had a commercial realtor helping me with this, but the first thing I did was position myself as being, in this case, like the Junry Institute, as opposed to being some, barely out of college guy with no money, looking to lease a space and be out of business in 90 days, right? And so if you've been established for a long time, or even if you're new, this example is new, but you really want to put together the big package. And as a member with us, you have so many high-quality, full-color materials and so forth. Think in terms of give them the big package of information and show them, the leadership and master club and the revenue stream and all the marketing material and everything you do. And you make a real case and a presentation about all the marketing you're going to do for the shopping center. You talk about you're a destination location. You're going to have several hundred families coming to the location 2 or 3 times a week. Therefore, you're going to be supporting the Italian restaurant, the pizza place, the Hallmark store, whatever it might be. And the more you really position yourself as a professional and it's everything from how you dress, and it used to be make sure you go to the meeting in a jacket and tie. Nowadays things have gotten a little bit more casual, but it's everything from how you dress to what car you drive up in to the presentation you give them. Because the more convinced that you are financially stable and substantive, ironically, the lower rent they're likely to give you. And the more they're convinced that, you know, you may or may not be in business in 6 months, then in counterpoint, they try to jack up the rent and they try to give you less of a deal if they rent to you at all, because they've got to build in that risk factor that it may well be they rent to you for 6 months and you're out of business and they have to put in another tenant. And so what I have always found most effective is laying the groundwork ahead of time to really have their expectation of what this is. And again, you know, over the years I would have a, you know, commercial realtor who was doing the interface for me. But what I would always make sure I did is I drove the deal, didn't let the realtor tell me what to do. And the first thing I would do is I would put together the big substantive package about, you know, how long we've been in business. And in everybody's case, you can use your relationship to the National Association of Professional Martial Artists, and you can show them all the color marketing materials and all of that stuff. But you put together the plan, and the first contact that you have is always that. It is a big package of robust and substantive stuff that shows them how credible you are. And, of course, the more you have, if you've been in business for 20 years, you've been a pillar of the community, you've been awarded the Chamber of Commerce Award, or if you've had, you know, 22 articles on you in the local paper, you include all of that in the package. You don't leave any ammunition on the table going in. Matt Smith, what would you say next from there for positioning yourself to get the best deal with them?
Well, I know when I went in, that the package that you're talking about, when I took in some covers of the magazines and the different articles, you know, the NAPMA, I think at that time, had done the cover story on me, and there was also an article in a previous one before that, a caring new breed of millionaire type of thing, but
yeah.
Anything that you can get that's going to show, you know, your credentials in your field that are going to strengthen that, whether that be a newspaper write-up, testimonials from community services and projects, things that you've done. So, I mean, I would list a bio that would include all of those kind of things and how long you've been in the community, how long you've been in the martial arts, and that way it's just going to solidify your position. If you've been running a school for how long, how many students, all that kind of stuff, you know, it all adds to it. And that what they're looking for is the hardest, I think, position for anybody to be in is when it's your very first school, you're just new to the field, and your chances of succeeding in new businesses opening without previous business experience, you know, having other successes is very low. But for somebody who's been in the field for a long time, they know if you've been teaching for 10 years or so, then you have some credibility. So all of that longevity.
And it's why, you know, landlords always prefer a brand new business owner who's part of a national franchise. So they would rather have, you know, the guy who's doing a, you know, whatever it might be, a Pizza Hut, or any other kind of business than Joe's Subs or Joe's Pizza or whatever. Because what they know is that most business owners come with technical skill sets. They don't come with business, you know, competency. And this is the same way. What they expect of the guy wanting to open a martial arts school is that he's an accomplished martial artist who doesn't know anything about running a business. And what their expectation is that 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10 aren't going to last very long. And so, therefore, what you want to do is use all the materials that we have available and put it all together in a real robust package. Use your association with NAPMA and so forth as part of your credibility build. And again, the more of your own stuff you have, great. And if you don't have a big package of your own stuff, you know, Matt Smith, you had everything from things, you know, articles from the Washington Post, you know, to a National Martial Arts Magazine. But if you don't have that, you just use all of the tools and so forth that we have. And what I really mean by that is they're mostly concerned with, is this somebody who knows how to run the business, or is this somebody who's just technically competent at the thing they do? And, you know, we all know the technical competency at the thing you do doesn't keep you in business and doesn't pay the rent. So they really want to see, mostly, that you have a plan for marketing, getting the students. Two, that you have a revenue model that makes sense, so that they're going to really have a sense that you're going to be able to make money. I mean, they really care about three things. They care about, are you going to make enough money that you can pay the rent, right? Number two, they care about, are you going to be a good contribution to the tenant mix of the shopping center or not? And then number three, they care about, are you going to be bringing traffic to the shopping center that will support the other tenants, or are you going to be kind of an island unto yourself that's not very worthwhile? And what we know is that if it's an office type of tenant, they're not all that enthusiastic about that, because what happens is, you know, it doesn't draw much traffic to the shopping center. But if it's again something like Starbucks, or if it's a national food franchise or something like that, that they're excited because it draws traffic into the shopping center and supports the other tenants in the center.
And what you said, Master Oliver, when I gave him my package, I also, you know, when I include all the Mile High stuff, I will say they were more impressed with me being the national director of the franchise, and Mile High being part of a national franchise, because, as you said, all the shopping center owners know that there's a much higher success rate for businesses that are franchised than those that are mom and pop, and that's why most shopping centers are looking for named franchises to come into their center, and that's always going to be their first choice over a mom and pop.
Yeah, and I would say it probably goes in the hierarchy of three things. If they have a national tenant, in other words, they have something like Starbucks where it's not a franchise, they tend to like that. But then if it's a local owner-operator, they want the local owner-operator to be part of something bigger than themselves, and to have an obvious business system in place. And again, we're not trying to pitch you guys on the franchise. What you can do is use all the materials that NAPNA and the Inner Circle make available for you, and bundle those together so it makes a really nice presentation. And again, you know, if I give them a 300-page packet, what I know is they're going to glance at it to give it some credibility, but mostly they're not going to read it all. What I want to do, though, is I want to position it so that they know we have a real business system. We have a price structure. See that, you know, and again, they don't like cheap. What they want is they want somebody who's got enough of a revenue structure that they know they're going to make money and be in business. And then the next thing they want to know is that you're going to look and feel and act professional, not the handwritten signs on the door and all kinds of rinky-dink stuff. Any questions about all this so far?
Master Oliver, this is Tim Harrison. I'm curious, is there a correlation, you know, you mentioned negotiating free rent. Is there any correlation to the term of the lease and how many months free you might be able to negotiate?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, there's another moving part as well. You know, one moving part is how much they're willing to spend on doing build out on the shopping on the space itself.
Mm-hmm.
Two is how much they're willing to give you in rent abatement, and three, the term of the lease, right? And what I would say, the other component is of all of that is their perspective of how substantive you are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the less substantive you appear to be to them, the less willing they are to spend money in build-out. So you can still get a lot of rent abatement. And what I was always looking for, again, when I did the original schools and since, is, you know, I tend not to like brand new shopping center space that's never been built out. You know, I'd rather have it was a shoe store or it was, you know, pick a tenant, something that was carpeted, big open space, you know, the bicycle's an 18-month deal. You know, the untold secret about that was most of them were women's fitness centers who'd gone out of business. You know, because that was in the Jane Fonda era. So what happened in the Jane Fonda era, same as happening today, is there was all kinds of, you know, small women's fitness centers who opened on every street corner and then closed. So I think three of the first five had been small women's fitness centers already built out.
Did we lose you? We did.
I'm sorry. But the add to that. You've had the experience on both sides.
I didn't know what you wanted me to add to that. So.
Well, you know, from the standpoint of rent abatement and TI money, right? Is if I can move into a space. And I'm saying to them, you know, we're going to need zero TI money, you know, there's tenant improvement. But what we want is X amount of free rent. And I'll always give them a rationale for it. You know, that's always the best of all worlds. Because, you know, if they don't lease to me, it may be sitting on the market for another year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I get what you mean. Now, having done
both,
I did... One location I did the build-out on, the other location they did the build-out on. The one that I did the build-out on, they gave me, they were allowing me $100,000 on a build-out, which ended up costing me about $40,000. The other one, they did the build-out, so whatever it cost them, they only gave me 3 months free rent, but it took them 6 months to build it out. When I built it out, it took me 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the pros and cons of both of those. The one that I built out in 30 days, I got 8 months free rent. The one that they built out, I got 3 months free rent. They gave me no credit for the build-out, obviously, because they did the build-out. But it's because it took them 6 months, they told me that it was going to take them 90 days. To cover my bases, it wasn't a shopping center. There were several empty spaces in the center. Two doors down, you know, which was just right next door, there was an empty store. It was a carpet store, and it had gone out of business. And or they left anyway, open down the street somewhere. And so I asked them if I could use that place until they did the build-out. And they said, well, just pay the utilities and we'll let you do it. Well, I did that, and so I was in that location, which was just bare walls because it was carpet, so there was no offices or anything. There was a bathroom. But it was obviously carpeted since it was a carpet store. I put up a petition wall, you know, just those freestanding walls and a desk in there, and we taught intros and signed people up. We put a blueprint of our build-out next door. We would take them over and walk them through and see them doing the build-out and what it was going to look like. And so we started doing pre-opening specials. And we were teaching them out of the carpet store. Well, in those 6 months, we grossed over $250,000, and I hadn't even started paying rent yet, and much less my 3 free months kicked in. But that was not how much paper we signed. That was actually cash in the bank from down payments and paid in full because
we offer some black belt specials and special memberships. And we started from the first day at a bigger discount, and then sliding discount each month. That discount started getting smaller until we were back to zero discount when we actually opened. So, which is the best? Well, I enjoyed the money in the bank and the free 6 months rent next door, even though it wasn't a really finished space. And then the extra 3 months turned out to be a great deal. It could have been a problem for me had I not had the foresight to figure out what's going to happen if they don't have it ready in 90 days. And I would have had to start signing up people from day one in 90 days rather than from when they started the construction. So to be able to go into a place next door, keep that in mind. If it's going to take you a while to do the build-out, but that's a good alternative. In the other space, because I had a location, I was just moving it across the street, I coincided the change dates to where when we closed the one location, the next day we opened in the finished location across the block. So pros and cons on both. So it's not the deal you get, it's how you turn the deal that you get into something profitable for you. So keep an open mind when you're doing those kind of things.
Yeah, and if I could say, if I had my druthers, Master Smith, I would have, I don't know how many times over the years I've had it where they promise the construction is going to be done on August 1st. And the construction is done on January 1st instead, or, you know, something in between, right? And I don't know if I've ever had a construction project that was done on time. And if I had my druthers, I would rather it be that they're giving me money and I'm handling the contractors rather than vice versa. But I always have it where the lease payments don't start until the CO is pulled and all the construction's been signed off on, and always have a backup plan to be able to run classes and run the school during that time. And again, to be up and running quickly, you know, like my first school, it was Sandy's Way to Fitness that had gone out of business, and in fact, when I started negotiating the lease, they were still in business. They didn't know they were getting ready to be, you know, pushed out of business. And I signed the lease on August 1st and started enrolling people on August 10th and had about 100 students before the actual lease started. And see, if I had my druthers, I like the example you gave, Master Smith. I had one that I managed to drag out for a year where, again, it was probably where I came up with the example of the shoe store. It had been a shoe store, and it was carpeted, and it was a, you know, clean space. And it was exactly the same. I had another one that where we were actually in the space, but they were doing construction around us. And I had about 1,000 square feet, and we went to the home, you know, whatever the home store was at the time, and got a big, you know, piece of remnant carpet. So I got a, you know, 500 square foot piece of remnant carpet, and put a desk over in the corner, and we were teaching intros. At the same time, it was, here's the blueprint, here's what it's going to look like. And, you know, in all of those cases, you can really create a lot of revenue in a hurry. And what a lot of people don't like is they don't like starting to teach class in a school that's not completely polished and finished. I've always found it's the opposite, is when it's the new thing. I mean, especially, you know, the best of all worlds, you can say we've been around, you know, been here 20 years, but, you know, landlords are late on the construction, here's what it's going to look like, here's the, you know, facility, here's what the old one was, here's the pictures, here's what's happening, and by the way, we're giving you a discount because they screwed up. I mean, that to me over the years has been the best of all worlds. I really hate when everything is finished and you've run out of time to have an excuse for the grand opening, and now you're just on the normal business. When you're in that case, I like to milk that as long as humanly possible. Would you agree with that, Master Smith?
Yeah, and one of the things the landlords like to do, if you're doing the build-out, they will have a drop-dead date, and they will say, okay, we'll give you 90 days to build it out. At the end of those 90 days, your rent will start. Or if you have free rent, your free rent will start at the end of those 90 days. And then if you run into problems with inspectors, you know, you're running into county inspectors on stuff and not approving stuff and slow contractors and stuff. So things can cause a problem. But I would say whether they're doing the build-out or you're doing the build-out, I would make sure that there's a place, you know, try to facilitate some place close by that you can be teaching classes and signing people up as a pre-registration to give them a special pre-opening discount. And, you know, by the time we opened that location in Sterling, the first, you know, when I first opened it, we had 180 students by the time we opened the doors. Well, when I moved it across the street, obviously we already had all those students. All we were doing was moving it from one location to the other, so we didn't need a separate location. But even there, I was doing, at that other location across the street, we had a big banner up and had a desk set up there and did pre-opening special and discounts, and then we would send them across the street to do their intros at our old location, because these were all the people in this shopping center that maybe hadn't even gone over to that other center to even know we were over there. And we actually signed quite a few in that period also. So, you know, make sure you have some kind of pre-opening specials and a place to facilitate teaching some students. Even if you have a pre-existing location, use that then as the feeder, but still in the new location, have your banner set up there and telephone numbers and somebody to meet or greet them or to send them over that way.
Well, there's another side of that coin too, by the way, where I think maybe a quick summary would be, so, you know, the playbook here is, you know, make sure that there's another space that you can start to conduct business even before you have occupancy of the original space, right, of the core space. And that almost always is doable if there's any other vacancies in the building, you know. I did exactly the same thing over here. I was doing intros in the construction zone, basically, same deal. But there's also another piece of it. If they're doing the build-out, if the landlord is doing the build-out, I always want to negotiate in a drop-dead date where they're then penalized if they don't deliver the premise to me on time. So you can basically negotiate that into the contract that, okay, if they're telling you that they're going to deliver the premises, let's say, on January 1st, I gave them like a 7-day grace period, you know, January 7th. If they didn't give it to me by January 7th, they were going to pay me 2x rent until they delivered it to me. You know what I'm saying? See, the thing is, if you don't have any kind of a penalty for them, if they don't deliver on time, then they don't have an incentive to make sure that they get it delivered to you on time. You know? So,
here would be the caveat I would say to that. If you have a deal like I had mentioned, Master Smith had mentioned, where you've built into the deal, they're going to give you the space next door for free, and then your rent doesn't start until after they, you know, sign off and the thing and so forth, I want to incentivize them to be the normal, slow, deliberate, late, drag it on forever. Right?
Right.
And I'm with you on that one.
I was hoping, you know, even when we opened in 6 months, I was hoping it was going to take another 3.
Yeah, I had one of those deals that I milked for 18 months. I was so proud of myself and so proud of them for being incompetent. I can't tell you. But if it's a situation which I've always tried to avoid getting in, but if it's a situation where you really can't watch your marketing and advertising, you really can't, let's say that I really am out of an old space on December 31st and have no place in the interim. And if they don't open in time, you know, the students are, you know, training in the park or we're having to, get a room at the rec center or something in the meantime, then I would absolutely negotiate something in like that, right? So there's two sides of it. One of the things that I think it was my idea, I'm not sure, but one of the things that Tim Kovar did when they were, you know, bringing in the capital and expanding pretty rapidly is he went and bought a trailer and wrapped it and negotiated into the lease that they could put the trailer in the parking lot and they could teach classes out of it. Prototypical, the health club thing used to always be, in some places it still is, where they would, you know, put the trailer in the parking lot and it would take a year and a half to build out the facility, and pretty much all their profitability came from the pre-sales, right? And so, you know, and that is another option. You know, option one is have the trailer in the parking lot. Option two, which is better, is to have the carpet store that's empty or the shoe store that's empty or something, and they give it to you. And the only caveat with that is sometimes they'll say, well, you can have that space unless we lease it to somebody. And now you've got to look at, is this likely something that they're going to, you know, have a temporary Halloween person or something come in, or a Christmas deal, or is it, you know, if it's a normal deal, if it's supposed to be from my space is ready, it probably takes them 6 months to get a lease and another 3 months to occupy. So I'm probably safe on that deal. You've got to juggle those things back and forth. And Tim, to go back and be directly responsive to your question, is you're always trying to juggle two things with a lease. You're trying to juggle in the current rent rate locked in as low as possible for as long as possible with having some flexibility. And I've tended to come to liking to do a five-year option type of lease. Is 3 years, it seems like, just once you get established in there, the lease is up, you have to figure out something to do. A five-year lease is a good time, but if things are changing in the market or if you decided you needed more square foot or less square foot, you can make that decision. But then plugging on a five-year option where you're guaranteed that at your choice you can keep the space an additional 5 years at the pre-negotiated rent rate gives you ultimate flexibility, because in practical terms, you're locking up the space and you know how much you're going to pay for 10 years. And on the other side of it, you have the opportunity to bail in 5 years if that's what you want to do. The other thing on the TI versus the free rent side of it, Tim, is that the better personal credit, the more business longevity you have, the more business assets you have, then the more willing they are to give you like cash. And when I say cash, I mean the more willing they are to put, you know, 100 grand, 150 grand into the space.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can figure out a way that they're willing to put in 150 grand into the space, but they're going to give it to me in rent abatement, and it's going to cost me 20, 25,000 rather than 150, I'm happier with that, right? And the thing over the years that it also bounces back and forth is, see, I like to go set up a new company, you've been in business for 20 years, set up a new company, the new company signs the lease, I don't personally guarantee it. And under those conditions, new company, LLC with no assets, and I'm not going to personally guarantee it, they're pretty hesitant, no matter how substantive I present it to be, that, you know, to give you a bunch of cash up front. Because obviously what they're seeing is pretty low commitment on your part if things go bad to make it work. Now, I usually wait till, you know, towards the end of the deal to present that that's the structure. But if you're personally guaranteeing that you've been in business forever, you're using the company that has a lot of assets and so forth, then they're more likely to give you money up front. And if you're not personally guaranteeing it and you're doing something like I just described, then they're willing to give you a lot of rent abatement on the deal in most cases, but they're not going to want to, you know, write a check for $150,000 for a specialized build-out that may or may not be useful for them in here. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's part of it. I think the length of the lease is
you know, they look semi-long-term. The difference to them between a 5-year lease and a 20-year lease may not be much of an impact, but the difference between a 3 and a 5 or a 5 plus 5 starts to be more significant to them. And, mm-hmm. you know, clearly if you're talking about like a year free rent, really all they're looking at is the real estate term is the effective rent per square foot. And the effective rent per square foot is you take, again, pick a number, $20 a square foot times 5,000, so it's $100,000 a year. $100,000 a year times 5 is $500,000. And then if they take out $100,000 for rent abatement and $100,000 for TI, you know, now they're down to $300 divided by 5 years. And they have a target pro forma of what they want the shopping center to return. And if you look like a national credit tenant and you're guaranteeing it with a lot of assets, then they're willing to take at the low end of their pro forma. And if you're not doing that, they're willing to, you know, be flexible on that and be towards the low end of pro forma, but they're usually not willing to put out a lot of cash. Okay. Was that responsive to your question, Tim?
Yes. I mean, and even more information. I mean, yeah. What I've got is a basically simple situation looking at a new place. They don't. It takes minimal build out, but they would like me to do the build out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've probably only negotiated one lease before, and that was when I first opened. So I guess I'm looking for some common practices where if I was doing a minimal build out and I was going to go in, say, for a 5-year, maybe with a 2-2-2 option, is it common to ask for 5 months free on that, or is it kind of ask for more?
Well, it's just kind of like thinking about what industry norms are, right? You want to not think about what's common. You want to think about what the, you know, what you can accomplish.
Okay.
And if the number I ask for gets a response from them that you know you must be on crack or you're crazy, I know that I have, gone to the right number, and I'm waiting for them to come back with something that they think is more reasonable.
Okay.
Right? And so, like this last deal I did, it was a 5-year deal, and I asked them for minimal build-out. It was a space that hadn't been occupied, but it had 2 bathrooms. It didn't have any flooring in it. And basically, it was they put in the heating and air conditioning and the electric and the lights and all that stuff, and then they gave it to me as a plain vanilla shell with 2 bathrooms built in. And in practical terms, we had, 10,000 square foot of matting sitting in the storage, and we had plenty of mirrors and all that stuff. So it was pretty much just throw in the mats and throw in the mirrors, and it was done. But the conversation I made is we're going to do all the additional PIs to it as long as you give it, good vanilla shell. But what I want is, 18 months free, and we'll do a 5-year deal. And I ended up with, the deal was 3 months free, pay a month, 3 months free, pay a month, 3 months free, pay a month, 3 months free, pay a month. And so it ended up with 12 months free over the first 18 months. Give them some comfort level. And mm-hmm. then they asked for a $10,000 security deposit. And I negotiated that down to a $5,000 security deposit. And so what you always find is with any negotiation, it depends in part about who owns the shopping center. It depends in part about who there is to the space. It depends in part on an entity, and it depends in part about how much square footage they have available. And in this case, was a fairly small owner, and it was the lowest space available in the shopping center, so it didn't have a lot of other stuff available. And it had been empty for a while, but once this deal was done, they were 100% leased, right? So you have some pluses and minuses. They weren't desperate. you know, was a fairly small owner but relatively deep pockets. He wasn't stressed for the immediate cash flow. You know, if it's a really small owner, you know, the dentist in the shopping center owns the space, it may well be that he's bleeding cash every month and he's desperate for cash right away. And now the promise of cash in a year, you know, doesn't fix his problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if it's, you know, Teachers Retirement Trust of Indiana that owns the space, is what you get is you've probably got a rental agency, you know, big national company controlling the property. They're going to be much slower to evaluate that it's a substantive, incredible tenant that's going to be there long term. And they're going to be more focused on their pro formas than they are on cash flow, right? So, and the pro formas meaning they're concerned with being able to put on paper what the property is generating so that if they bought it for $3 million and they want to sell it for $4 million, the pro formas justify the value of the property, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when real estate was really crazy with some of the stuff, you know, the banking crisis is one time and the, you know, the S&L crisis before was another time. But, you know, there were landlords who would do a $30 face rate, but in reality it was a $15 rent rate because they would, you know, throw in, you know, essentially half of it for free or something like that. And really all they cared about was the face rate in the lease. And then there's all kinds of things you could do with that. You know, right now, in some areas of the country, we're in a situation where retail space hasn't recovered fully. In other areas, you're in places where it's pretty tight. So, like, if you look at where Master Smith is, he's in an area where retail is pretty tight. I would say Denver is in an area that hasn't really recovered. California has been an area where rental rates have been really high, but their real estate market hasn't recovered, right? They got hit pretty hard. And for you and
talk to you again.
Did maybe Mr. Oliver dropped? He'll get back on in a second.
Sure.
What area are you
in? Just outside, about 40 miles outside of Chicago. The school's in Joliet, Illinois.
Okay. Yeah, we'll ask. I'm not sure how the Chicago area is. Are you familiar with
the market out here is still pretty open and recovering. There's a lot of open space. You know, rents haven't recovered to what they were 5-6 years ago at this point.
When I was negotiating my lease, and it was the fourth, you know, I was there, I had already been there for 15 years, so it was like the fourth extension of the lease, or the third extension from the original lease. I think the landlord didn't think that I was going to leave, that, you know, I was too ingrained there, so he was not willing, you know, feeling that he already had me, wasn't willing to negotiate. So when I went out and started checking the market, I had about 4 different properties that I was interested in, and then I started negotiating with all of them. And when I negotiated a counter price, first I asked them what they were asking. Then I would come back. I don't know if you've ever seen the show Pawn Stars, but you know, you give them a ridiculously low number, and then see how close to that they're willing to come. And so I started doing that on everybody. And then once one place would give me another number, then I know that on somebody else that I know that I could get at least that number somewhere else. So it really gives you a better feel for it when you're negotiating with more than one person, especially when it's in the same market.
Okay. You know, Mr. Smith, there's also, I mean, obviously, there's all sorts of market research tools on this stuff. There's a little app, like, for your iPhone or for Android called LoopNet. They have a website, too. But LoopNet, I'm not sure if you guys talked about it already. I was a little late on the call, but
no.
You can basically, it'll show you all of the commercially listed all the properties, the commercial real estate properties that are listed anyway. It'll give you a whole database of them, so you can look around and find exactly what they're offering and think, or what they're saying their rack rate is and stuff like that. So it's a good research tool either way.
Yeah, and keep in mind, and that app is LOOPNET, I believe, .com. And so if you have an iPhone, go to the App Store. If you have an Android, go to their store. But if you look at LoopNet, it is a useful tool. There will be properties that are available that aren't listed, that haven't shown up yet, and so forth. And the term you use, from the hotel industry, is the rack rate, is, they're gonna show the rate that they're asking, not the rate that they'll settle for. But from the standpoint of starting to look, at Massive Smith, that's what we were using in Sterling a couple of weeks ago, is, we're kind of driving around and you can pull up the little map and literally you can sit at an intersection and say there's a listing over there and there's a listing over here and there's a listing over here, and it'll give you their standard brochure information, space available from, 1,100 square foot up to 6,000 square foot, and, a rental rate from X to X, that type of thing. So it is a good opening tool to go look around. We laughed about the time I visited Al and Carol at their crop school. But, between that and the Zillow app, literally you can walk down the block around your school and you can see what the residential rental rates are, what the residential price home values are. You can see what the lease rates are going for. You can see what commercial properties are available. So the tools nowadays, are just incredible to accelerate your time and effort. The other thing we haven't talked about much is the negotiation, frankly, is the black magic of really, because again, you think about it, once you're in a lease, it's difficult to renegotiate once you're there. It certainly is doable, and we had a couple of the guys in the Inner Circle and Peak Performers who had needed to do that. I haven't heard any of them on the call today, so maybe they've resolved those problems. But it is possible, if you're in year two of a five-year deal, to renegotiate. The reality of the renegotiation, it depends upon how desperate they are. And it depends upon how much you can convince them that you're both viable and broke, which is an interesting mindset to be in. You've just got to convince them that your business isn't viable at what they're charging now, but it is viable at some lower number. And, you've got to convince them that they should bet on you in the long term, but, that you're going to be bankrupt in the short term at the current rates. And, we've done some pretty interesting deals over the years. The problem with that is you're always playing a high-stakes game of poker. Is what may well happen is they just, do the eviction and they kick you out and they get the judgment, and then you may not end up in the situation where you wanted to be in. But back to the lease negotiations, we've seen some pretty interesting things that you have to worry about in the actual lease document. And when you're negotiating these things, that's usually at the end point, but there are a couple of things to watch out for. One of the things I saw recently, and I hadn't seen it before, but somebody had a clause in their lease, and when you're doing a retail lease, most everybody knows in the call, it's usually what's called triple net. In other words, it's net of taxes, insurance, and common area maintenance, right? So, and common area maintenance is everything from snow removal to, they clean the exterior windows, it's all that kind of stuff. But I saw a clause in a lease recently somebody got tagged on, which was instead of CAM being computed as a percentage of the gross leasable space of the shopping center at the time, it was computed in such a way where there was a big national tenant anchor that left. I forget what it was, Safeway or something to that effect. And so now 70,000 square foot had left. There was, let's say, 70,000 square foot in the rest of the space. And the lease was written in such a way that the common area maintenance were divided by tenants who were paying for common area maintenance. It wasn't divided out by leasable square footage. In other words, the common area maintenance, the triple nets, I'm using those interchangeably, but it's inappropriate. The triple nets is taxes, insurance, and common area maintenance. The triple nets were apportioned based upon everybody who had left. So therefore, you know, in practical terms, it could be you have $7 a square foot triple net that suddenly goes to $14 a foot triple net based upon that being in the lease. So it's like the most, the biggest problem I've seen in a lease recently was a landlord having snuck that into somebody's lease. And so you do have to be careful of making sure that the triple nets are as a percentage of your space as contrasted with the current existing square footage of the shopping center, and that number is put in stone. In other words, if they condemn half the shopping center, or if a big tenant leaves or something, they can't apportion that to you. So that's one of the biggest gotchas I've seen recently, and that's a biggie. The other thing on triple nets is I've always negotiated a cap on them. And it's a lesson I learned the hard way. And I remember literally, you know, I was 25 years old. I had five fairly high rent locations. And all of a sudden in March, I got bills for each of them for like $5,000 or $6,000 a piece. And you can imagine the shock to your system that all of a sudden you get, I think it was $25,000, $25,000 in unexpected bills when you're 25 years old, didn't know that this is the way things work. And what it was is it was the end-of-year adjustments on the cans. The second year I was open in Denver, they had unusually bad blizzards. And so literally the snow removal had skyrocketed. And I got these big cam adjustments at the end of the year. So, you know, I learned my lesson on that. And so I always negotiated in a cap. So if they were saying the triple nets were $7, and by the way, you can negotiate that. You can negotiate what the current rates are down, which is, I would say, a little difficult to do, but it's doable. But you can also negotiate if they're saying the current triple nets are $7 a foot. If, you know, you can say it's capped at 7.25 a foot. So, all of a sudden the property taxes double, which has been, I've seen that happen in different places, or if suddenly, you know, there's blizzards, which, you know, parts of the year had that problem this year, parts of the country had that problem this year. If suddenly if there's blizzards and stuff, they can't all of a sudden whack you with a big bill at the end. Anything to add to that, Master Smith or Master Milroy?
No, you know, in my playbook, the other big gotcha that I'm always worried about, and maybe, you know, Florida is probably a little more dramatic, but it's HVAC, you know. So HVAC, like heating, ventilation, air conditioning, in most leases, you know, down here, I mean, look, if the HVAC goes out down here, it could be $20,000, right? Could be 25 grand, could be $5,000. I mean, you know, it might be cheap. But so
keep in mind to a lot of people, you know, $5,000. I mean, that's pretty big chunk out of your cash flow if it's unexpected.
Exactly. And in Florida, you can't, if it's June, you can't not get it fixed, right? I mean, it will kill people. You know, I mean, people will, you know, be suing you for like heat exhaustion and stuff. So that's always one of the big kind of pages in my playbook. I do kind of a two-step process. I always go up on the roof and I look at the HVA system, the air handler, and I look at all the rest of them in the shopping center. And if mine's old and the rest of them are new, I know that this one probably doesn't have long to live, right?
Yeah.
And then usually I'll have an HVAC contractor come out and look at the whole thing and give me a sense of it. And then in the negotiation process, my kind of default position is I don't want to be responsible for HVAC. They want you to be 100% responsible for HVAC. So in most cases, my position is, okay, listen, Mr. Landlord, look, that unit is 9 years old. It has an expected lifetime of 15 years. So there's only 6 years left on this thing. I'll be responsible for the first $500 of any repairs or whatever. You know, you be responsible for the rest of it, something like that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like my ideal situation. again, otherwise, if you have to replace the whole thing, you're only going to get, you know, so much of the lifetime value of the thing anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
But HVAC is a big deal. I mean, that can really, I've had it bite me in the ass once. It'll never bite me in the ass ever again, right? So,
yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that I always want to negotiate into the process. I'll be responsible for the first X number or whatever it is of any repairs or replacement. And then since, you know, this thing is going to stay when I leave, I'm not going to take it with me, right?
Yeah.
You'll be responsible for the rest.
Yeah, and a good point
on that, Toby, I had the same problem with my current location.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
With the first year I was into the lease, the blower motor went bad, and then the condenser went bad, and I replaced both of those at a cost of about $5,000, and after I replaced those, then the whole unit was bad like 6 months later. But the landlord actually came in and put in a new unit for me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I lucked out on it. It was about a $20,000 deal. And and the way that I got him to do that, I said to him, I said, well, look, this unit is the original unit, is what the air conditioner guy told me. You guys knew that. And so you knew that this was about the time that this unit was going to be going bad because the shopping center was about 15 years old.
Right.
And I said, and you told me that it was in good working condition. That would be no problem over the course of the 5 years. I said, remember, I do have a 5-year option here, and my judgment on whether I'll take that extra 5 years is going to be based on how you handle this.
So they said,
don't worry about it. We'll send our guys out. They didn't use my people, but they used their people, and my guy gave me a $20,000 estimate. I'm sure his people that work on all of their properties gave them a better deal, but still I didn't have to pay for it.
Yeah, it's just one of those gotchas. This can really, this can put you down. I mean, this is a big enough deal, especially, like I said, in Florida. And, I mean, Washington, D.C. in June isn't a picnic either, right? But it's just one of those things that it's a page in my playbook that I always, 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 always want to play because, let's say you're into the thing for 3 months, you're barely starting to get cash flow flowing, and then all of a sudden now you got to put 25 or 20 grand into HVAC. I mean, that could be a death nail, So anyway, as far as big gotchas go, that's a big gotcha for me.
It is, and way down on the list from the priority standpoint is, always know and ask, whether things like trash removal are included in common area maintenance, whether the maintenance on, and this is an important one, not a very big expense, but whether the regular maintenance on the units are included. And, I've been guilty of it myself, when I was running 6 locations, a lot of times, we would have somebody who would just service all 6 locations. I didn't worry about it. When it's less than that, a lot of times it's just something that, slips off your plate. But one of the important things especially on the air conditioning, is that the filters are getting replaced on a regular basis and everything's being checked out and it's being, the Freon's being checked, all that stuff. And you do want to know whether the landlord is doing that or whether it's your responsibility to do that and make sure you're on top of it, right? So, again, it's not a very big expense. It's not in the range of, it's going to be 20 grand to replace the AC in July. But in order to avoid that 20,000 in July popping up, if you have somebody who comes out and services it monthly or quarterly, I think it's usually quarterly, they'll spot problems ahead of time. A lot of times minor maintenance keeps it from having major breakdowns. And you need to know that somebody's doing it. And, again, my preference would always be that that's the landlord's responsibility built into the CAM. And it would always be my preference that the landlord, take the, what you just said, Master Miller, that it's the landlord's problem on the HVAC over a certain dollar amount. So, I've had leases where CAM covered the service contract. It covered all the minor service. And that if there was any kind of major service, it was the landlord's responsibility, and that's the best of all worlds. And again, the logic was in negotiations as well. I'm signing a 5-year lease, you know, the AC has a 15-year lifespan. If I did have to replace it, I'm basically giving you, you know, 10 years worth of use for whoever comes next. You know, it really shouldn't be my responsibility for that. And, you know, how much do you make that a make or break issue in a negotiation? You know, if you're moving into a brand new space, you want to make sure that it's, you know, everything in the lease is warranted. And it may not be, you know, a crisis that they're not willing to move with that. If you're moving into something, a 20-year-old shopping center, is you want to make sure that it's built into the lease. And, you know, and certainly within that, you can go, you know, look on the roof and have a contractor come out and look at it. And if they're not willing to cover it, you know, to the extent they're not willing to cover it, it may be they know that there's a big expense coming and they want to stick you with it. But you can certainly check it out, and if there's brand new units that were installed 6 months ago, it's less of a concern than if the units have been there 12 years and, you know, you know that you're going to get stuck with it. So you have to make those decisions, because sometimes they're willing to do the kind of deal that he just talked about, and any reasonable person is going to understand the argument of, I'm doing a 5-year lease, those things have a 15, 20-year lifespan. You know, if it does come to them needing to be replaced, it really shouldn't be that I paid for 100% of them. So that's not an unreasonable argument. And the more they're unreasonable, the more of a red flag they're giving you on the way into the space.
And that's all. You might underline that too. That you the point you made just a second ago, whether there's a service contract or not. And again, this goes back to HVAC. But you do have to watch inside the lease. There's typically a clause, well, there can be a clause, that defines whether there is or isn't a service contract and who is or isn't responsible for that. And, again, what I'm describing is sometimes in the lease it says, you, Mr. Tenant, Y and Z every month to the HVAC system. You know, you have to run a tablespoon of bleach down the drain, or you have to change the filters, whatever it might be. And in those cases, you know, pay the expense of having the local air conditioning company come out and do that, because then it's documented, and if it ever comes back, you know, if there is ever an issue with HVAC, and they say, well, you didn't maintain it, you know, that's a big issue. So it's just a way to cover yourself on that. But you do have to watch inside the lease. In many cases, they want to give you some responsibility so that if you don't do it, right, they then have a recourse to say, well, you didn't take care of the thing. You didn't, you know, take care of the thing as you should have. Therefore, it, you know, you're responsible for it breaking, you know.
Yeah, it's really no different than having a service contract on a car. You know, if you buy whatever it is, you know, a new Mercedes, and you have a 5-year service contract, but you never get the oil changed. You know, and now the engine seizes up. You know, they now have a reason to void it. And in this case, if it is your responsibility, always just go get the service contract, because, you know, they're not very expensive. You know, like anything else, you know, get a larger, credible company, but, you know, bid it out with two or three, because, you know, you'll get widely disparate prices. So I would prefer typically not to have the little fly-by-night guy, unless he's like one of my black belts and I trust him and he's credible. Other than that, you know, you want to always have that in place. Other questions on this? We have 2 or 3 minutes and we have to run. Any other questions on this topic, on negotiating lease properly? I guess the one thing I didn't say yet in the call, which is the standard, is if there are 3 things that I see that almost all school owners mess up, is on their expense structure, is they almost always end up with too high a lease payment for too much square footage. And, you know, and the 3 things are, they underspend on advertising and marketing, they, you know, they have too many people that are getting paid and they don't pay the highest quality people enough. And then 3 is they overspend on rent, and usually overspend on rent because we all kind of want to have the Taj Mahal. And what I'm concerned about with rent in priority order is the demographics of the immediate neighborhood. In other words, I want to, and we haven't talked about this, it's probably fodder for a different time, is I always want to pull good demographics. I want to know the income area. I want to know, you know, I mean, shorthand, if there's a lot of houses on golf courses with three-car garages, I'm happy. And if there's government-subsidized low-rent apartments, I'm unhappy. And if there's, you know, fairly high amounts of wealth concentrated among mostly 70 or 80-year-olds, it doesn't do much good, right? So I want to make sure the demographics of the immediate area are really good. And I want to look at projections to know that over at least the term of the lease, they're going to continue to get better, not be on a decline. Number two is, with rent, you're really paying for two things. You're paying for, you know, square footage in which to train, and you're paying for advertising. So, given my druthers, I'd rather have smaller square feet in a active, busy shopping center than have more square footage in, let's say, a warehouse. So priority number one is the quality of the demographics of the immediate area, let's say the immediate, you know, 1 mile square, you know, range and the 3 miles. Number two, I'm concerned about how much of the rent is going towards advertising, how much of the rent is going towards actual square footage. And I'm always aware of that trade-off, right? So, you have the, you know, the issues of how much visibility the space has, but how much foot traffic does it have, and how much house, you know, or conversely, is it hidden or is it in a visible shopping center with low foot traffic? And, you know, if I have my choice of, let's say, a $3,000 a month rent and an $8,000 a month rent, one of them has visibility, no foot traffic, the other one has foot traffic and visibility, I'll probably go for $3,000. Because I know personally, and I know that the materials we're giving you, is the extra $5,000 I can compensate for the foot traffic with advertising and marketing activities. But it is always the trade-off. So I have to recognize that part of the rent is based upon location demographics. Part of the location, the rent is based upon visibility and foot traffic. And I want to balance those things out. That having been said, is, you know, if I have my choice between a 10,000 square foot school with marble floors and, you know, expensive finishings and, you know, all that kind of stuff, or 2,000 square feet next to the grocery store on one side and movie theater on the other side, every day I think I'll take 2,000 square feet. From the standpoint of how much square footage do you need, the rule of thumb we came up with years ago, and I found it holds up pretty well, is 7 square feet per active student. In other words, 300 active students, 2,100 square feet is adequate. Now, it might be a little tight, but it's adequate. So I do see a lot of schools that have, you know, 150 students and they have 6,000 square feet. I've talked to a couple of them that were excited about moving into a 12,000 square foot space with 150 students. See, that's completely in reverse of what you want. Is, it's, again, think about, you go to a restaurant, you go to a little Italian place that has 22 tables and there's 22 people on the sidewalk waiting for their table and all the tables are full. Your assumption is it's a good, you know, good restaurant. You go to the place that's 20,000 square feet, has 200 tables and has the same 20 people in, your assumption is there's something wrong with the place. So I'd rather have it be a little tight and have good advertising, in other words, a busy shopping center, and have good demographics than have, you know, 10,000 square feet in a warehouse buried somewhere, especially buried in a bad neighborhood. So you always want to balance that back out, back and forth. When we visited Eric and High in Houston, is their location was not a high foot traffic location, but it was an extremely busy street, 120,000 cars a day. Extremely good first impression, and now they just put a very big, expensive monument sign out, but pretty visible. So you always want to be balancing that. But the thing to watch out for is to watch out for getting too much square footage. Don't move into, you know, the empty shopping center or the warehouse. Move into the place that's busier and better whenever possible. And I have to balance out foot traffic and visibility, but, you just got to make an informed decision. And again, you know, when we do our one-on-one call, is that's the kind of conversations we can make, because it is nuanced, is how much rent you want to pay for foot traffic, what type of foot traffic it is. One of our peak performance members, Greg Macy, who's Greg, you may be on the call, but you know, he just did a deal. It's right next door to a very busy Target. In his case, I would say the premium and rent for the visibility and traffic has been well worth it. But there is a break point on that, and the break point is you have to make a truthful decision for yourself: how much time and how much advertising dollars is it going to take to make up for a less traffic shopping center. The last thing I would say on that topic is, it's really a sin to have a busy traffic shopping center and then not have tons of signage in the windows, flyers on the front door, TVs running in all the windows, the door open, a booth out front, and be there from, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Have somebody be there from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. is what worst thing you want to have is a heavily trafficked shopping center, lots of foot traffic, and only be there in the evenings, because in most of those busy shopping centers, that's not when most of the traffic is. Most of the traffic is, mid-morning and late afternoon, so you want to make sure you have somebody there to take advantage of it. Anyway, any last question, or Master Smith, Master Monroe, anything to add to the topic before we wrap up?
I think you covered it pretty in-depth.
Yeah, okay. Any last question before we wrap up for the day?
I'd suggest if anybody, if anybody did have anything that didn't get covered, feel free to email it over, and then we have a couple more calls this month. So I think we've had a call next week, right, or something like that. So
yeah, we were going to do a call on Monday on Renewal Blitz, and then we were going to do a call on Wednesday, the regular Maximum Impact call. So and Mark, we will certainly add in something on buying a property. We do have some interviews with and footage of Chris Hearn on the site, don't we?
I think so.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head.
I'm not sure where I have it. Yeah.
I know that he did we had another video from one of the Stream Success Academy events, and we also have done a couple of interviews with him. So you might search for Chris Hearn buy your own building or property, and you'll probably come up with some of that stuff. And if anybody's looking to buy a property, he's probably the guy who can handle it the most effectively and get you the best rates on any kind of SBA deal, which is typically the way to go unless you get an owner carry. But we can follow up and do that at a later date. Well, thank you, Master Smith, for your contribution. Thank you, Master Milroy. Thanks to Tim Harrison for your questions and input, and thanks to Marty Callahan for your questions and input. And we'll talk again next week.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you,
sir. Thanks, sir.